Welcome to Worlds Apart. At first glance, today's geopolitics has little in common with religion or spirituality, but as tensions exacerbate, Russia, the United States, the European Union, as well as China, are framing them in starkly existential terms. And while mutually assured destruction still seems an unlikely dystopia, what about mutually assured coexistence or mutually assured security? Is that just as improbable? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Langxin Zhang, Distinguished Fellow at the Stimson Center in Washington, D.C. Professor Zhang, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Yeah.
Now, you coined a very interesting phrase or even a concept. You call it an ecumenical or non-denominational peace, which presupposes peace as the highest value, and you contrast it with the concept of democratic peace, peace that is conditioned on your opponent, whether, you know, that opponent shares your values or does your bidding. And that made me think that, you know, the tensions that we have in the world right now is ultimately a struggle for the very meaning of peace.
That's right. That's right. That I'm sure that this is the issue the great powers, I'm talking about China, US, Russia, and several others, disagree. Now, from a Chinese point of view, I will put it this way. The war in Ukraine, it's a war outside of Chinese cultural sphere. In other words, this is a typical war. Mm-hmm. From a Chinese point of view, in history, that Christian civil war. It's a Christian civil war, which take place many, many, many times before. Now, since today's world order was established by Christian world, and we are still living under a system which was established at 1648, or the Westphalian system. Now, from a Chinese point of view, this is nothing really surprising, because one is, this is a continuation of another internecine war within the Christian world. Mm-hmm. Has nothing to do with China. Culturally, historically, this is your war.
Well, it's your war, but it's affecting you as well. I mean, as well as the entire world.
That's for sure. That is for sure. No, let's leave Taiwan issue aside for the moment, because let me explain this. The problem for this civil war within Christian world is caused by one side, particularly on the Western side, refuse to admit the fact we are still living under a Westphalian system. Therefore, now Westphalian system has two elements we all know. Anyone study international relations, right? One is sovereignty, which is the Western bloc emphasize on. The other is called the balance of power. That is to say, great power needs to have a sphere of influence. This is really the rules of the game.
Now, can I ask you specifically about peace? Because I think this is a very deep idea. When peace is actually conditioned on whether or not you like your opponent, whether, you know, he shares your values or whether he, you know, supports your policies, doesn't that turn peace into an instrument of war? I mean, that's because we think of peace as a philosophical or human value, but what you're talking about is ultimately making peace a weapon of geopolitics.
Well, it's not so much making peace a weapon for geopolitics. That's not the case. The case is after the end of Cold War, we have a long period of peace where the Western bloc seem to believe they can continue to push the red line of other major powers because they believe they own peace. They own the basic value of maintaining peace.
Oh, this is what I'm calling, you know, why is it called the ecumenical war? Because that they are still talking about a rules-based international order. But that rules-based international order actually was violated by themselves because they ignored the second part of the Westphalian system.
Absolutely. But I mean, the largest premise, I think, in their conception, and which you highlight so eloquently, is that they are the ones who are controlling peace. They can grant peace to you and they can take it away from you.
Well, that's exactly, I think the biggest mistake is a NATO enlargement after the Cold War. NATO enlargement is pushing the Russian envelope too far by ignoring the Russian need for a red line for sphere of influence. Now, Ukraine, of course, Russian being repeated many, many times, it's basically ignored. Mm-hmm. Basically ignored.
Professor Zhang, can I go to that word ecumenical, which has certain religious connotations, and it's an interesting coincidence because in 10 years Christians across the world are going to celebrate the 2000th anniversary of Jesus' resurrection, and Christianity's various denominations still cannot agree on how to perform the Eucharist, you know, this major rite within the religion tradition, which, you know, creates and fosters disagreements among various branches. So I think in a way it supports your thesis that the Western civilization is prone to sort of internal infighting. But I wonder what makes this animosity so lasting, because from a rational perspective, you know, a win-win solution is always the best. And yet for some reason, Western civilization seems to be advocating the win-win, but choosing in practicality something else.
Well, remember, in Christian world, there is an ecumenical movement which emphasizes the compromise between the different denominations. But Western Europe, or now United States, seem to have never really reconciled with the Orthodox Church throughout history. It has very little to do with communism or anything, you know, other modern ideology. Mm-hmm. So this has been a historic legacy there. Mm-hmm. I don't believe they found a solution yet. But then what they did make a mistake is after the Cold War, we could have a long period of peace, ecumenical peace, if you will, but they ignored the other side of the vital national interests. Mm-hmm. This is, by the way, it's a similarity between U.S. and China over Taiwan issue. That only in that sense it's a similar. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there is zero similarity mm-hmm. between Ukraine and the Taiwan.
You mentioned the Cold War, and I remember Mikhail Gorbachev, who was the last General Secretary of the USSR, remarked a few years after the collapse of the Soviet Union that the biggest sort of crime or the worst thing that the Soviets or the Russians did to the Americans was to deprive them of an enemy. That Americans right. need an enemy as a sort of structural concept within their own worldview. Do you agree with that? And if so, can the Americans be ever compelled to accept peace on ecumenical rather than democratic terms?
As a single superpower, United States always needs a rival. If we know at the end of the Cold War, Americans at that time were talking about end of history. In other words, with you know, anyone who is not a democratic country will be the enemy, will be the rival for the United States, and they will be defeated. But they totally ignored, of course, Mikhail Gorbachev's Russian contribution to the end of the Cold War. This is where I think I would believe George Kennan is the one who got the whole story right. Mm-hmm. George Kennan is the major opponent to the NATO enlargement. And he even predicted what might happen today. Mm-hmm. But George Kennan or people like Henry Kissinger were basically ignored by the administration mm-hmm. of the United States.
Now, Professor Schenk, as you pointed out in your articles and lectures, historically the Russians and the Chinese have had many, many disagreements. Under communism, we actually fought a war, and after the collapse of the Soviet Union, we had roughly 8,000 border disputes. What has allowed this bilateral relationship not to be hampered by all these disagreements and ultimately get them diffused?
Well, I think pragmatism is the key here. I think both China and Russia, after the end of the Cold War, has done one important thing that is totally ignored by the outside world, Western world. That is, they made almost 20 years efforts with through secret diplomacy of settling their large number of border disputes. I used to think we have 7,700 border disputes. That, you see, border disputes could be trigger for any kind of conflict between two countries who share such a long common frontier. I believe Mr. Putin actually corrected my data. At one point, I was attending a Valdez club in Sochi. He said it's 8,000. So I believe his data. That means with a patient diplomacy, we are dealing with real issues that affecting peace. Of course, nobody give us the peace prize, of course. Nobel Peace Prize, they will never give to us.
I cannot resist sharing that with our audience because I learned it from your lecture that the Chinese language used to have a special term for the Russians, which literally translated as old hairy man and metaphorically meant worse than barbarians, the European barbarians or the Christian barbarians, I suppose. I wonder if you have coined any new term for us, the Russians, now.
I don't have a new words. I think, well, yeah, you can say some a brotherhood, I would say. Yes, it's not, as I say, the relationship improved based on the sincerity of both sides to resolve the real issues. And you also, you know, have to pay attention to the regional organizations China and Russia initiate, which is Shanghai Cooperation Organization. This is the only regional organization China actually initiate and participate.
You know, in order for that to proceed, the two sides had to believe in some sort of ecumenical peace rather than conditional democratic peace. I mean, maybe they not have cited your concept, but there should have been some idea that we are on the equal basis here and peace is in our mutual interest. Based on that, do you think it's fair to put Russia in the Western camp? Because I think throughout Russian history and throughout many wars we have fought, we have always sought, you know, fair peace with our adversaries rather than, you know, making advantage of them.
But the Russian has one historic problem they have not been able to deal with. That's my view. The so-called Euro-Asian complex. Whenever they had a chance, they prefer to integrate with Western part of the Russian world. Gorbachev used to say common European house. It's a wonderful idea, but they often encountered rejections on the Western part from one reason or another. At that time, Russians seemed to be moving toward the East. This is a typical Russian behavior. Now, my personal view is Russians still have that complex with them. But now Asian side become far more important for them. They seem to be able to overcome that complex. They began to realize the Russian-China relationship plus Central Asian countries together could create a common community that will maintain peace for Euro-Asian heartland.
Well, at least for its Asian part. We don't know about the Euro part, but Professor Shank, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back to this fascinating discussion in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Problem is the cost of housing keeps on going up. Cost of living keeps on going up. Inflation keeps on going up. Yes. Gas keeps on going up. So all the cost of living keeps on rising.
I had a voucher over the summer and I still wasn't able to find housing because there's no affordable housing in Lakewood.
I've seen an increase in people calling me, asking me for a place to stay, needing a tent.
And yeah, we've had people that have been millionaires in the past, you know, had big businesses. Different things can throw you over the edge, you know, so people shouldn't be so judgmental about the homeless because it can happen. It can happen to almost anybody.
I think the government needs to help all these homeless people.
Yeah, I know.
Instead of sending money over to Ukraine and all those other countries, worry about your own country. I just wish we had a president that cared. But we don't have a president that cares. I wish people would wake up and see what Joe Biden is doing to us.
People don't realize in the deep that America is in. What is this kind of immorality happening in our nation? And people taking back like, oh, it's okay.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Langxing Chang, Distinguished Fellow at the Stimson Center in Washington, D.C. Professor Chang, before the break, we were discussing the so-called Russian Eurasian complex, which I think would be more accurately termed as Russian inferiority complex before the Europeans, because we always thought that everything, you know, most inspiring and enlightening is somewhere in the West. But I think this shift that you mentioned is happening not only because of Russia's newly discovered interest in the East, but also because of the Russian realization that we ourselves may be a civilization in our own right, and that we don't need to, we can cooperate with all nations on an equal basis, but we don't have to change ourselves to be liked or approved. I wonder, and I would ask for an honest answer from you, do you believe that Russia rises up to a level of civilization?
It's hard to say. I'm sorry to say that, because Russians, they always start from very beginning, Kievan Rus, from the very beginning, you have an empire. You never have a Russia, I mean, in the strict sense, as a nation state. So you are used to empire, but you don't know how to run a state, basically. So this is, I think, you only had a state, a Russian state, in the very short period of time, which is very different from China, because China had a state, centralized state, since 221 BC. There is no dispute about that, the timeline. So Russia probably still need to learn quite a long time how to make a Russian state a civilization. I do not see it for now, but I think Russians were striving for it. I think Mr. Putin has a great ambition, try to make it a Russian civilization. Mm-hmm. But I have doubts to believe it's going to happen very soon.
Now, Professor Chang, regardless whether Russia is a state or a civilization, it wants to leave its own national destiny. It wants to develop to according to its own vision, according to its own necessities, rather than serving somebody else's bidding. And many in Moscow believe that this is at the crux of the tensions with the West and the current conflict in Ukraine. I wonder, how do you see it, what's happening in Ukraine? Is it a regional conflict, or is it part of a larger struggle, including a struggle for the meaning of peace?
Well, first of all, it's a real tragedy. This is an internecine. It's a brother killing brothers, no matter what. It's a sad story. Yes, but it is also, as I explained before, I believe it's the Western bloc's ignorance about recent history, or refused to accept recent history, that is primarily responsible for leading to that sad situation. Having said that, I'm not condone anybody who invade anybody's territory. I mean, as a scholar, I don't accept that, no matter what.
Speaking about that, many Russian experts believe that the Russian military intervention in Ukraine came only when the Kremlin calculated that a military confrontation with the West was inevitable. Regardless of what we do, we cannot compel the West to retract by goodwill. I wonder if that conclusion about the inevitability of a clash with the West has already been reached with Beijing, because your red lines are also being actively pushed right now.
Well, yes, there is no question about that. In China, of course, Taiwan is the issue here. Chinese actually say it's the core of the core interests. So China emphasizes even more about Taiwan issue. Now, you're absolutely right. It looks like the United States in particular seem to be pursuing the same pattern of behavior, ignoring that core of the core interests of China.
Ignoring now, or purposefully destroying or neglecting it?
What the United States want to do is they want to pursue a policy called One China, One Taiwan policy. United States claim they never abandoned One China policy. They are not pursuing Two China policy, but they choose something in between. That is a perpetuation of One China, which is a legal one, but there is another one which is not really legal by international sense, but it perpetuates that Taiwan independence. So it is the de facto Taiwan independence policy. Mm-hmm. For China, this has already crossed the red line.
You have written before that we are now living in a pre-World War I situation, and obviously nobody before 1914 knew what could become a fait accompli, but I still want to ask you, what could possibly constitute the red line for China, the crossing of which may become the point of no return?
Well, in the case of China, it's the U.S. further elevated Taiwan's international status. You see, you have Nancy Pelosi's visit, which already created crisis. If you have Anthony Blinken, I'm sure China will start a military operation. I don't have even doubt about that. It depends on the level Americans try to elevate Taiwan's international status. That will be the red line Chinese cannot tolerate. Besides, this is not Ukraine. Taiwan legally is part of China. There is not even a dispute about that international community.
But I mean, we live in a day and age when legality or international law is not estimated as the highest value. Just as, for example, peace is not taken as a highest value. So I wonder what kind of a response and how measured do you think China will be in the case of for more open provocation from the United States? Because nobody wants the war, right? Nobody wants an open conflict. But the American strategy seems to be cutting the dog's tail piece by piece, you know, this slow encroachment. So when enough will be enough for China?
I think by sending military, large number of military personnel to Taiwan, either for training purposes or other purposes, or begin to supply a large number of advanced offensive weapons.
So the same thing that happened in Ukraine, you mean the same thing that happened in Ukraine would trigger China into action?
Well, it's the same thing. I think it's unfortunate Mr. Putin was taken in by Minsk too. Mm-hmm. We now know, I mean, Angela Merkel and Hollande, they all say, you know, Minsk too, it's just buying time for rearming Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So Chinese learned the lesson there. Mm-hmm. We will not accept another Minsk too, mm-hmm.
Now,
so to speak.
Speaking about the Chinese position in the Ukrainian conflict, and I know you claim neutrality, but in observing what's happening there, I wonder if China at this point would be more interested in the defeat of not so much Ukraine, but the Western actions in Ukraine. Do you think that would lead to some humbling on the part of the West? Or do you think, on the contrary, the defeat in Ukraine may prompt the West to look for, you know, some compensation elsewhere and for opening of a of another war theater?
Personally, I don't think these two are directly linked. I don't think so. What Chinese really wanted is to somehow work out a ceasefire. I don't believe Chinese have any capability to work out a peace treaty. That's not in their cards. But if they can work together, maybe with Macron or some other leaders, to have a ceasefire, a stop killing, basically, that will be extremely important for China.
But do you think the Russians would agree to that without accomplishing their strategic goals? Because, as you mentioned, the Minsk peace deal was essentially a ruse for allowing Ukraine to rearm. Is it in Russia's interest to, you know, allow for another ceasefire and wait for a war a couple of years down the line?
Well, from my point of view, Putin already got new territories.
Maybe, but it wasn't about the territories. You know that, Professor. It wasn't about the territories, ultimately. As you said, it was about NATO encroachment, constant encroachment, and neutralization of that threat.
Well, but if you already got four territories, which means at least you have a buffer zone you created in practical sense, I would see Mr. Putin should have interest with the ceasefire. Mm-hmm. It is Zelensky who may not be willing to do it, because he lives on Western aid. Mm-hmm. He does not want this aid, the bloodline, to be cut off. Mm-hmm. The really hard part is Zelensky. Mm-hmm. That's my view. I think Russian should be able to do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Professor, can I ask you about this aid line issue? Because a couple of European thinkers, including the prominent German sociologist Wolfgang Strieck, expressed their concern recently that Washington is now trying to Europeanize that war. That is to shift the burden of financial responsibility, the burden of arming, the burden of training onto the European Union, first and foremost onto Germany. Do you think that's possible? Do you think the Europeans have enough resources to fight that war for the Americans and support that war for the Americans?
I don't think they have efficient weapon system or resources, but they have money, though. Europeans are not poor. The EU countries are rich countries. Mr. Trump is right to criticize European NATO members paying too little for NATO. So yes, United States now support Ukraine. Eventually, they will delegate the duty to European part of NATO. That's the American plan, mm-hmm. pure and simple. I see it, yes.
And finally, if I may, many in Russia took note of China appointing its own envoy for dealing with the Ukrainian crisis. Do you think China can offer anything to Ukraine? Not to Russia, because with Russia you are on good friendly terms, but can you offer anything appealing enough to Ukraine to make it interested in the so-called ecumenical peace?
Well, reconstruction, help in reconstruction. Remember, China is a leading investor and a major trade partner with Ukraine. Before the war, Ukraine has 14-15% two-way trade with China. And we invest enormously in there. The war actually, you know, damaged a lot of Chinese investment. So Ukrainians know that, and they have interest for the future reconstruction. I think this is one card Chinese will play. Mm-hmm. Besides, Chinese may be able to persuade Zelensky that ceasefire is not a bad idea. Ceasefire, think about the Panmunjom in Korean Peninsula in 1953. Ceasefire hold it for almost 70 years anyway, mm-hmm. despite you don't have a peace treaty. Mm-hmm. And also Zelensky does not have to recognize the territory taken by Russia, right? If you have a ceasefire agreement.
I truly hope that the Chinese can be effective in that. I'm sure it will serve the interest of the Russians, the Ukrainians, and pretty much the entire world if they succeed in doing that.
Right. I hope so, too. I hope so, too.
Well, yes. we have to leave it there, but thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.